How many times have we talked about the apocalypse? So many things that could affect all of our lives. In a moment, Dr. Ken Hansen joins us, noted author and lecturer and founder of The Time, Treasures in Time. Tonight, we talk about the apocalypse on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Dr. Ken Hansen back with us. Ken, of course, as I mentioned, is an author, lecturer, founder of The Treasures in Time. That is an organization that he devotes to disseminating knowledge of the classical world, the biblical world as well. He has looked at archaeological sites in the Middle East. He has been all over the place and, of course, noted author as well, including The Visionaries, The Armageddon Code, The Paranormal Bible as well, and more. Ken, welcome back. What a day to have you back.
What a day. Good to be with you, George. Good evening from and good morning from the University of Central Florida, Orlando.
Hey, what's going on down there?
Oh, we're just enjoying a very nice spring. Wonderful to be in Florida in the springtime, especially with these holidays, religious holidays all around us. We've got Good Friday, Easter, and in the Jewish world, we have Passover around the corner.
Oh, we do too, and in the Christian world, we've got Easter right around the corner.
Exactly.
So here we go. The world, according to the experts with the apocalypse, so many civilizations, Ken, have thought that they were in end times. They were in the apocalypse. What makes this any different?
Well, yeah, you're right. And from time immemorial, civilizations, even in ancient writings, seem to have been obsessed almost with the idea of the end. Really, there's a concept that history is directional. It's going somewhere. There was a beginning, and therefore there has to be an end. And this has been a recurring theme. I call it an archetype. Archetypes and paradigms in human history and human thought, and especially as a scholar, to be able to trace this back across the centuries and across the millennia to find that what people are thinking about today is not that much different from what they've been thinking about from time immemorial. Namely, there's a sense of an ominous type of foreboding. And you look at the world today, and my goodness, it does seem to dovetail with some of the ominous warning signs that have been there from the beginning. We have the power to literally transform our civilization into new levels, new experience, new dimensions that the ancients could not even dream of. And yet at the same time, simultaneously, we have the ability to wipe ourselves off the map. And that's a staggering thought. And it's like we're caught in the middle. And especially in the Jewish world, Jewish thinking, I'm a Judaica scholar, there's this concept that, hey, nothing is set in stone. I remember the old Lawrence of Arabia film where our hero says, nothing is written. Don't tell me it's written. We choose. We choose which way we go, and the way we direct the future is really in our hands, and we can choose either of these options, and they're right staring us in the face. And I hesitate to say this as a scholar, but I'm nervous. I'm looking at the world around me, and I'm looking at these ancient writings as well, and these archetypes and these paradigms, and I'm thinking, my gosh, maybe we're closer to this end than we have ever imagined.
It sure does seem that way these days, Ken. Now, when people talk about the apocalypse, of course, it's a horror going through it, but they all talk about something wondrous at the end. Is it worth going through this horror, this living hell, to get to this point?
Well, it's interesting. Again, as a Judaica scholar, there's the concept that we don't have to go through that. Actually, in Jewish thinking, even though contemporary Jews know very little, if anything, about this, Jews today think of the present tense and don't even like to go into apocalypticism. That's considered something passé. But it's in the ancient writings that there's not one, but two messiahs. there's a Messiah, son of David, who could bring us into this glorious age without the birth pangs. But there's another kind of Messiah called the Messiah, son of Joseph. People don't know, either Jews or Christians, that there ever was such a figure. But he's in the ancient writings, a different Messiah, a Messiah, son of Joseph, a suffering Messiah, a dying Messiah, who will be part of what ancient Jewish texts call the pangs of the Messiah, the birth pangs, as if the whole world, the universe, is in travail, struggling to bring forth this glorious age, and yet we have to suffer in order to get there. But it's not written. We can get there without it, without the suffering, but we don't know which way we're going to go. And what I am fascinated with is looking at both Passover as a feast and Easter to find that, that there is apocalypticism, believe it or not, written into both of these wonderful springtime feasts.
See, I don't know, Ken, how we can get to that point without going through this mess that the Bible talks about.
Yeah. Well, indeed, there's two different visions, and it may be that we've got to go through the mess. But there are also ways that we can avoid it. And the ancient sages said this. Even more contemporary Orthodox rabbis have said that if we join together, if we band together and begin to actually perform the basic common sense commandments from on high, that we can actually postpone or even eliminate these birth pangs. I think Israel is right at the heart and the key of it, and specifically the city of Jerusalem. What happens there is going to determine which path we take.
Ironically, Israel has been pretty quiet in this latest round of Middle Eastern tensions with ISIS. Other than some skirmishes, of course, a few little ones, they have seemed to be relatively out of this picture. I assume, is that a good thing?
For now it is. Actually, Israel's enemies seem to be preoccupied
right. In
Syria. Hezbollah in Lebanon. I lived and I worked actually in Lebanon for some time with an American television news gathering operation, and I know the area quite well. I've seen terrorism. One of my good buddies was murdered by terrorists in Lebanon. That place is just it's beyond words. It used to be a glorious gem.
It was the jewel of the Middle East.
Isn't it the truth? And even when I was there, there was a Christian enclave in the south of Lebanon. They called it Christian Free Lebanon, and we had a little ragtag television broadcast operation right there in Christian Free Lebanon, trying to light a candle, as it were, in the darkness and broadcast some wholesome family-oriented programming into a war zone in tandem with these brave Christian militia who were trying to hold off the terrorists. But all that is gone now. That whole Christian enclave is crushed. The place has been overrun by Hezbollah that just the other day directly threatened the state of Israel, saying we have missiles, and they're absolutely correct, that can strike any part of the state of Israel. And they specifically directed their threats against the Israeli nuclear reactor at a place called Dimona.
Oh, geez. That is truly an act of massive war, if anything happens.
I'll tell you, yeah. But I said all that to say that Hezbollah is now sidetracked with the civil war in Syria, in tandem, of course, with Iran, and we've got the Russians, and we've got...
Well, is Hezbollah on the side of ISIS or on the side of Assad?
They're trying to prop up Assad against all of these rebels. So they have been distracted, and that's why Israel seems to be a bit on the sidelines, including ISIS, that is trying against Assad. So it's of course, in Iran is the specter over all of it. They're controlling a number of capitals in the region, from Tehran, of course, to Beirut, to Damascus, into Iraq. They've got their tentacles everywhere. everywhere as a Shiite force, and then there, of course, are against and fighting the rebels, the Sunni militias, and especially this ISIS group. They call in the Middle East, they call them Daesh, which literally means stomp or stamp upon their enemies. All have been distracted from Israel, thank goodness, although Israel is keeping a careful watch on the Golan Heights for any type of movement, any type of threat, and fortunately they don't dare threaten Israel. But this is the bullseye, honestly, of world history, and what happens in Israel, and including American foreign policy toward Israel, I think is going to make the difference in terms of these pangs of the Messiah, this term most people have never heard of. Are we going to suffer these birth pangs? And if we do, how bad, how serious are they going to get? Hey, it boils down to Israel and what we do regarding our best ally in the region, and I think the strongest force in the world against this face of terror that we've just seen again this week in Brussels.
Yeah, absolutely. And some people believe that we are already in a war, a third world war. What do you think, Ken?
I'm afraid I have to agree, and I would have been reticent and reluctant to say such things in the past. Again, I'm a scholar, and we have to be very rational, of course, and very scientific, and we have to avoid exaggeration and hyperbole and all of that. I think it's time for some serious cries of anguish and woe in terms of what we're looking at out there. I'm scared. I'm scared for my own children and the world that they will grow up in, because sadly I don't see us standing with our closest ally in Israel. On the contrary, just within the past week, the past days, there's been yet another plan hatched, literally, to advance the destruction of the State of Israel, and it has to do with France, and sadly with our own United States government, that in tandem with the French are calling now for an international conference on Israel and Palestine, the goal being to adopt a resolution for an immediate Palestinian state and withdrawal of Israel to the 1967 borders. Then following that, of course, we could expect a United Nations resolution amending their charter that created Israel to begin with in 1948. Yeah. They would amend their charter in order to declare internationally the immediate existence of this Palestinian state, and that would also provide a legal basis for this whole BDS boycott, divestment, sanction movement internationally against the State of Israel. This is catastrophe, and we're looking at this develop literally within the last week, within the last days. This plot is being hatched behind our back, and the sad thing is that even within Israel, there has been such a degree of frustration with this ongoing mess, as you call it.
Sure. Well, I think most Israelis can, and you correct me, would like to see some Palestinian homeland carved out somewhere for them. Am I right?
That's been the case for a good many years, but I tell you, that is, even that is, appears to be changing now within Israel. Even Roseanne Barr, I was just watching Israeli television the other day, and they featured her on Israeli television. She just made a trip to the State of Israel, and she said, you know, for the longest time, I favored two states for two peoples. I've just been in Israel, she said, and I got to tell you, I'm beginning to change my mind about all this.
Why would a trip change your mind? What do you think?
To see it up close and personal and what it's really like there. I lived it as well. As I mentioned, my good buddy got murdered just over the border into Lebanon. You live with this every single day. And I had another friend in Israel who had lived there for decades. In fact, he was an eminent Christian Baptist missionary, had been there some 40 years and was friends with the mayor and scholars of the Hebrew University. Back when the city of Jerusalem was divided into east and west. Well, that is all on the table again. It's an active
plan.
That's
not good.
to divide Jerusalem. Well, my buddy, the Christian missionary, was trying to get a little Arab child who had somehow gotten over into the Jewish West Side back east to his own people in the Arab East Jerusalem. Well, the city was divided. There were landmines, literally. There was a no man's land. I first studied at a school in Israel when I first went there that was literally located in the no man's land.
Is that what he hit, right? A landmine?
He stepped on a landmine.
Oh, did he have the baby with him?
The child was uninjured, but my friend, it blew his leg off. He ended up in a hospital on the east side. Lucky he survived. He lived the rest of his life with a prosthetic limb. But that's the reality of divided cities. You know, we saw it in Berlin. They want to turn Jerusalem into the Berlin of the Middle East, and they call it a peace process. I mean, this is a war process. And when we see this being hatched in front of our eyes, and a lot of this doesn't even get any news coverage.
No, that's because everybody's concerned about all this ISIS stuff. They don't look at anything else.
Sure, right. Behind the scenes, and now the French are involved, and in Europe, it's a rabid call for this immediate Palestinian state, and if Israel doesn't grant it, well, then we're going to slap on sanctions, literal economic sanctions, and many Israelis have just had enough and say, look, we'll allow it, okay? It's going to be difficult. We will take the old city of Jerusalem, what they call the Holy Basin, and we'll allow it to be, say, internationalized and hope that somehow it'll all work out. And we'll take these holy sites, which include Christian sites as well. You know, Easter, as we say, is right around the corner. We've got the location, I'm convinced, of the crucifixion of Jesus, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's an amazing archaeological site. That's part of it as well. Today, all tourists, everybody, and citizens, my goodness, have right to visit all of these sites. Christians go there. Jews go to the Western Wall, the holiest site in all of the Jewish world. And, of course, Muslims have free access to the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque up on top of the Temple Mount. Right? It's as good a situation as we could get, and yet all that is about to change. You take what, you put an international border, right, and a hostile border at that, right at the Western Wall, and on top of the Temple Mount, you've got Palestine, and now down at the side, you've got the Jewish state. This is a recipe for disaster, for catastrophe, and you throw in the specter of international terrorism, the threat from Lebanon, Iranians getting nukes, and I'm terrified, honestly, for the world that my children will inherit.
What is Netanyahu doing about this? Is he going along with it?
Netanyahu is a very wise and crafty, fairly right-wing Israeli politician who has in the past said, oh yes, I support a Palestinian state, which used to be unthinkable back in the day when I first went to Israel as a young student to study Hebrew as a language. Palestinian state, this is just a wacko talk. Netanyahu actually said, oh, I support it now. On condition, of course, that the Palestinians will recognize
Israel,
the state of Israel, as a Jewish state, knowing that they won't, that they have no intention of recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. So he gives himself cover in that regard, because in his heart of hearts, Bibi Netanyahu also knows this is a recipe.
Well, didn't Yasser Arafat at least admit that there was going to be a Jewish state and admit to its existence?
Technically, at Camp David, and of course,
and then after he died, it fell apart.
President Clinton was there trying to get him to sign on the accord. Prime Minister Ehud Barak in those days was ready to give away the farm. He said to Arafat point blank, I will agree to divide Jerusalem. And this caused an uproar back home in Israel, but he said, I will agree to divide Jerusalem. Just sign on the line right here, sign on the line, saying this is the end of the conflict, end of the conflict. And Arafat, at that point, walked out.
Yep, he didn't sign. We're going to come back and talk more about an impending apocalypse right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Ken Hansen with us, Dr. Ken Hansen, of course, and we're going to take your calls next hour with Ken as we talk about the apocalypse. So do you feel, Ken, we are indeed in end times?
The ancient sages certainly felt so. In the Jewish year, we're actually in the year 5776. Now, there's in Jewish thinking, going way, way back, there's a 6,000-year cycle from the beginning until the end. And then at the end of the 6,000 years would be the Messianic Age, right? So do we take this literally? We're in the year 5776. Or do we take it symbolically? The ancient sages also said, may the soul of those who calculate the end rot. So you better be careful about that. But there is a sense, and even 20th century Orthodox rabbis declared, especially when we look at the Holocaust, we're looking at the beginning of the end. And actually, as part of that cycle, there is a concept of 70 years of struggle and travail, these pangs of the Messiah. And many of these rabbis said, hey, look at Hitler. This is the beginning of that final 70-year period. But again, we have to be careful because, of course, you take 70 years from the Holocaust, and we passed that already. But these are archetypes, the way I look at them. And I see, the way I see it, is that there can be more than one tribulation, quote-unquote, even in Jesus' day and back to Easter. What was Jesus' message as he was being taken away to be crucified? Was he talking about theology? Was he talking about how you can now receive forgiveness of your sins? No, instead he looked at these women who were in mourning and said, whoa, blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore. This is an apocalyptic message because even in that day he saw a cycle. He saw a cycle coming. It wasn't the final cycle, but sure enough, within a single generation of Jesus uttering those words, blessed are the wombs that never bore, this horrific revolt erupted upon the land of Israel. The Roman Empire came in. They crushed it brutally. The city of Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. And we've had no temple, no Jewish temple on that site from that day until this. More than 1 million people lost their Jews, were slaughtered, says the historian Josephus. So Jesus was correct. He uttered a serious prophecy of apocalypse in his own time. But that doesn't mean that there can't be cyclical fulfillments, the way I look at it. And we've seen them over and over in history, and especially in the Jewish world.
Ken, the way I see the apocalypse, there's supposed to be an antichrist involved in this. Do you see that from your perspective?
Well, the Jewish sages certainly saw that. Christians call him the Antichrist. Jews would call him the Mashiach Sheker, the Messiah of the lie, or the lying Messiah. There is that concept as well. And I'm thinking of the famous passage in the book of Jeremiah that was later quoted by Patrick Henry, they shall cry peace, peace, and there is no peace. That's a lie. Right? That's what the Antichrist would do. That's what the lying Messiah would do, to cry peace, peace, when there is no peace.
Is that Antichrist here now?
The message is. I can't play pin the tail on the Antichrist.
Who is it? Yeah. Tell us.
And people get in trouble when they try to do that, and also when they try to set dates. How many times have we had dates for the end?
The rapture is near, right?
And it's sad because what it does is it inoculates people to serious warnings that are out there. Oh yeah, it's happened. They said it would happen in the year 2008 or whenever, and it didn't. So I'm not going to think about it anymore. You know, we shouldn't set dates to begin with. You look for times and seasons in general, and these things can repeat themselves in history. If you're looking at Hitler, there are people in that day who thought Mussolini was the Antichrist and Hitler was the false prophet. Well, heck, I wouldn't deny that. They are one more fulfillment of this. there was an Antichrist in the days of that great revolt 2,000 years ago, when the emperor, the Roman emperor-to-be, general at the time, Titus, literally came into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, cut the curtain with his sword. And the ancient Jewish texts say that blood spurted out from the curtain as he severed it with his sword and committed profane acts in front of it. That's a defiling of the temple. That's a type of Antichrist. See, these things can happen over and over. And there's something uncanny in the human spirit that does sense danger. And even a sense of our future selves, if I can be so bold, I'm not going to say looking into a crystal ball. That's not what prophecy is. But there is a sense, and remote viewers do this all the time, of being able to look into our future selves.
Yeah.
And sense something out there, something, it's like our brains, our souls, as it were, are receptors of a larger consciousness. And there are messages of foreboding, ominous messages, and far be it from me to set a date or say that this is the end, but I think that we are right now, we are in World War III as we speak. Not to say it can't be stopped, not to say it can't be avoided. Support Israel, that's the best way. But it's begun.
It has begun.
It's a civilizational conflict, literally. It's a civilizational conflict between forces that literally oppose everything we think of as civilized society and want to bring us back to the 7th century. And we're prepared to do it.
And let me ask you something very aggressive. ISIS, would you nuke them?
I don't think you have to. I don't think you have to. I would say we need to fight wars like we used to, like we did in World War II. You send in the heavy bombers. What's the capital of ISIS? This place they call Raqqa. Turn it into a parking lot. It's an awful thing to have to say, to send out the heavy bombers to do that, because a lot of people are going to die. A lot of innocents are going to die.
Aren't they mixed in with the women and children and everything?
Yeah. Look at Berlin in World War II. Look at General Patton in World War II. He said, if you want to know what hell looks like, you can visit what Germany is like today. That's what we did to Germany. That's the only way to win a civilizational conflict against forces of evil that we cannot imagine. By the same token, ISIS has already been losing ground recently, even with the Russian efforts, even with the Iraqi efforts. They've lost up to 40% of the territory that they have controlled in the last couple of years. And that's a staggering amount of territory to lose, as well as a lot of their oil revenue. However, the caveat is it makes the situation more dangerous than ever, because as ISIS loses ground on the ground, loses territory, what does it do? It's turning to more asymmetrical warfare. And that's why we saw Brussels the other day. And we can expect more of that. Doesn't take a lot of individuals to literally cripple a city, to grind things to a halt, halt commerce, halt everything. Just a two or three suicide bombers, and that's all it takes.
Oh, that's all. I know. You can literally shut down a city with that.
Exactly. That's what we can expect. Right. Until we reach a point that we're willing to fight them in the way that we used to fight wars. And you don't need nukes to do that.
Well,
but they want them. They want nukes.
And they would use them.
They are going to get chemical, biological, and ultimately they're going to get nuclear weapons in their own hands if they're not stopped. And talk about apocalypse. Talk about a sense of ominous foreboding. I mean, I want the bright future. I don't want this. I don't take any pleasure in talking about this. And we can have that. You know, when you look at the kind of technology, you talk a lot about it on the show, the kind of things that await us. And, you know, the prophets talked about that as well in the Messianic Age. There are hints of ancient prophecies that even hinted at interstellar travel in the Messianic Age and clothing that would virtually manufacture itself, right? And you look at the state of Israel today, they call it the startup nation. And it is. I mean, every week there's some new technological advance. It's unbelievable. Just the other day, there's a report that a new Israeli company has figured out how to produce batteries, a new type of battery that will charge. You don't even need sunlight, just from the light in a room. We will never need to charge batteries ever again. I mean, one thing after another. That's one possibility for us. And the other is this most horrific doom. And we're staring at either one. Which way are we going to go? Jesus, the great Rabbi Jesus, talked about the wheat and the chaff growing up simultaneously. That's a beautiful parable, a beautiful analogy, and that's what we've got. Wheat and chaff together, and it's up to us to decide.
Can we win this, or will we make a mistake, a tragic mistake?
We can win it, but our enemy is division. Our enemy is division. If we had the same attitude in World War II that we have now, where opinion is fractured all over the place, where we cannot get behind any one modus operandi to literally win it, we would have lost. We couldn't have defeated Hitler. Division is our enemy. It's our enemy in this country, and unfortunately, it's also the enemy in Israel. The country of Israel, as I started to mention, is deeply divided now. I'd say the majority of Israelis are waking up to the fact that this Palestinian state idea is a non-starter. It better not happen. But there are still a good percent of the population who will do anything for peace, for this elusive peace, crying peace, peace, when there is no peace. Right?
Well, where would they put the Palestinian homeland? The Golan Heights? Where would it go?
It would be in Judea and Samaria, which the rest of the world calls the West Bank, the Palestinian territories, and Gaza. And it could potentially include the Golan Heights, but that's really something that is the idea is to give that back to Syria. Can you imagine Syria? Today's Syria is going to occupy the Golan Heights. I'm sure you've stood up there. You stand up on the Golan Heights. You literally look over the Sea of Galilee. You can see Tiberias on the other side. Jordan used to shell. They had gun emplacement. They'd shell Tiberias across the Sea of Galilee for years and years, up until the Six-Day War when Israel won this territory from Jordan. Now this international body wants to give it back to Syria, and the Palestinian state is about 40 miles wide from the Jordan River to the coastal plain of Israel. It would leave Israel with about 9 miles along the Mediterranean coast, right at Tel Aviv and Haifa, separating Galilee in the north from Jerusalem and the Judean desert in the south, 9 miles, to create a 40-mile-wide enclave that is supposed to solve the whole problem. What are you smoking?
Do you think Israel has enemies from within?
Well, yeah, exactly. And the nation is divided. And
did you ever think you'd see that?
As long as I've been in Israel, yeah, the state has been divided. That on the one hand, it's a healthy thing because this is the only real democratic form of government the Middle East has ever known, ever. And that means there's lively debate. It's all over the place. You
yep.
You put two Jews together, you have three opinions. Right? And that's part of the secret of the startup nation, why they can innovate, why they can come up with amazing high tech every week they've got something. But the downside is that the enemy sniffs the division. And they say, if we just keep it up long enough, the current thing is this knife intifada, where every other day there's another stabbing of innocent Israelis. Just keep up the pressure, keep up the pressure.
And yeah, I mean, they're just like walking, and then all of a sudden somebody lunges out at them, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that's the face of terror. It's exactly what terror does. Israelis know exactly how to handle this. But there are voices within Israel saying, look, the whole problem is that this Palestinian population, they're sitting here in the quote-unquote West Bank, which we occupied in the 1967 war, because we haven't given it back yet. They're just upset and angry, and they're frustrated. And there's a sense of hopelessness that they have, and that hopelessness is what's driving all this violence. Give them hope.
Could the Palestinians live with Israelis in Israel peacefully, in your opinion?
If they wanted to, absolutely. I mean, this could be the Middle East version of Switzerland, you know, where you have people of different culture, language. You've got German, French.
Would they be welcomed in, Ken, or would there be too much suspicion now?
Well, that's the problem. If all you have to do is change your attitude, the Palestinian population is living right alongside the most successful, the most innovative people, the Jewish people, ever to exist in human history. As neighbors, all you got to do is extend a hand, and this could be the most thriving community not only in the Middle East, but one of the most thriving communities in the world, certainly. The technology, I mean, talking about making the desert bloom and the new innovative techniques, desalination, Israel has now pioneered drip irrigation, just a little pipe along the ground and just drip, drip, drip water, and you can make the desert bloom, literally. Mm-hmm. Imagine what could be, and that's again why I look at two different messiahs. There's a Messiah, son of David, who can bring in this glorious future, and then there's the suffering Messiah, the one that Jesus identified with, this Messiah, son of Joseph, who sadly brings in birth pangs and woe. It's up to us, and sadly, the Palestinians have decided that instead of extending a hand to the most productive people on earth, so many of them have decided, not all, mind you, but so many have decided we want to wipe them off the map.
That's the sad part.
That's the sad part, because they're wonderful people. You know, I having lived there, I've known many Palestinians, many Arabs. I've studied Arabic as a language and Arabic culture myself, and these two cultures are so close, and that's another part of the tragedy.
Absolutely. In retrospect, when they carved out Israel in 48, should they have given the Palestinians something at the same time?
Well, Israel was prepared to. Actually agreed to the UN partition plan in those days that would have created an immediate Palestinian.
What happened? Why didn't anybody take that?
The Israelis in those days said, yes, we accept the Arab population. There was no quote-unquote Palestinian Arab population. It was just the Arab population, the Jordanians and all of the surrounding countries flatly rejected the UN partition plan.
They didn't want Israel to even have a state at that time.
Exactly. So Israel was invaded by actually six Arab countries simultaneously in 1948. And they still were not able to take Judea and Samaria or even the east half of Jerusalem in 1948. That's why the city was divided for so many years. That's why my friend ended up walking into a no man's land and stepped on a landmine, because in 1948 they weren't able to take this territory. It wasn't until 1967 when the Egyptians, in tandem with the Syrians, tried it again and started mobilizing for war. Israel struck first. They telegrammed to King Hussein of Jordan saying, please stay out of this. This is between Egypt and Syria and us. And Jordan's response was they opened artillery fire all along that tiny border with their neighbor,
Israel. I remember that.
All
right, we're going to come back and take calls with you, Ken, as we talk about, are we on the verge of the apocalypse? Ken believes we're already in a new world war. We'll take your calls next.